The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Words We Live By, the summer series of the Eternal Light program, which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today we present the 11th in this series of 15 literary dialogues on love, human and divine, featuring two of America's foremost men of letters, Maurice Samuel and Professor Mark Van Doren.
Do you know, Mark, when we were talking of the calamitous love episode of Dinah and Shechem, there was at the back of my mind those two very lovely lines from Wordsworth, old, unhappy, far-off things and battles long ago. There was an unhappy thing, there was a battle there, the sacking of the city. And the line re-echoes again in my mind when I think of the what I've called the disastrous love episodes in the Bible that we're going to speak about today. All of them have that far-off, melancholy, twilight effect of a sadness that can recur but is belongs to a legendary time. Their unhappiness is almost not human. It's like some dirge, some everlasting dirge of the capacities of human beings for suffering.
And the pain that was undoubtedly felt then is not felt now. There is a cushion of time. There's a chamber, so to speak, through which time brings the words of these things, and the cries change to a kind of music. Homer speaks of that somewhere. Someone in the Odyssey speaks of that when he speaks of the tragic events of long ago as things that now give pleasure when beautifully sung.
Well, pleasure in a way. Thinking, for example, of Samson's love for the Philistine women. There is in it recollection of things that went very badly at a certain time and yet fitted into a pattern. Samson and the woman of Timnah, Samson and Delilah. You've noticed, of course, by the way, that most people don't know anything about the woman of Timnah in Samson's life.
Although her story in relation to him is exactly like the story of Delilah in relation to him. Both of them were asked by the enemies of Samson to betray a secret that he had, and both of them persuaded him to tell them so that they could tell the enemies. There's no failure in the parallel.
We remember Delilah because she was, she was in at the kill, as it were. She did the final betrayal, which resulted in the capture and the blinding of Samson. But when I go back to think of that effect of distance, the melancholy of the years, I'm thinking also of a love that was ordained, in which a man betrayed himself. It was ordained, and it served a purpose, and the man was caught up in historical or in divine purposes, wasn't aware of it, and while the thing was being played out, it had nothing but sorrow and anguish in it. You remember, there's that passage when Samson, having grown up and began to move between Zorah and Eshtaol. There's a Samson country in Israel. It's a certain section, by the way, that people often go to on the way to Jerusalem and wander around in the area which is dedicated to his memory. And we read, Samson went down to Timnah and saw a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. And he came up and told his father and his mother and said, I have seen a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. Now therefore get her for me to wife. Then his father and his mother said unto him, Is there never a woman among the daughters of thy brethren, or among all my people, that thou goest to take a wife of the uncircumcised Philistines? And Samson said to his father, Get her for me, for she pleaseth me well. But his father and his mother knew not that it was of the Lord, for he sought an occasion against the Philistines. Now, at that time, the Philistines had rule over Israel.
Mm-hmm. And his father and mother did not know.
Did not know.
And of course, Samson, neither did Samson.
Neither did Samson. Here is one of the riddles of the Bible. A man is involved in a purpose beyond his seeing, beyond his intentions. His passions are used. He is a pawn in some great, let's say a great chess game, if that isn't derogating from the seriousness of the issue. He is being used. The thing was from the Lord. You see the imperiousness with which Samson speaks to his friends. Get off of me.
Oh,
there's
yeah.
No, there's no argument here. He doesn't say, well, I'll see that she Judaizes. I've looked for somebody else. You know, I've been trying to find a bride among my brethren. I didn't. He simply says flatly, get her for me, and that's the end of it.
Yes, and now, you know, Samson, who I suppose is the least, outwardly at any rate, visibly the least spiritual and intellectual of all the heroes of the Bible, Samson behaves here just like the young savage, which to all intents and purposes,
by the way, you've hit on something. You know that the rabbis, the commentators, say that he was the least important of the judges.
Mm-hmm.
They do put him on a low level of the men of that period who ruled over Israel and judged Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you see, he was an instrument of God's purpose.
Yes, and when you say that he was one of the judges, you remind me of what we've had occasion here to say before this. Namely, that throughout the whole period of the judges, the people were in constant peril from their enemies. They were constantly being punished by God for their backslidings and their stiff-neckedness, and were being delivered to their enemies for punishment. Except that from time to time, after a generation or two, someone would rise among them to save them. God was the punisher and God was the savior, because just as God at certain times let the enemies have their will with them, so he at times raised up, as the phrase was, one of them to be a judge or a savior. Now, Samson, I quite agree with you. Samson is the least distinguished of these persons. He is a person of gigantic strength. He is a person purely primitive, whose passions, as you say, are being used. And I dare say that is the very special distinction of this story. He is always being used. He never knows what he's doing.
Well, there's something more about him. He is aware of something wrong with him once he retires and withdraws into solitude. Apparently, there was a tumult in his soul. All of this was too much for him. It's as though you had taken what you've called this primitive and you involved him in matters which were forever beyond the reach of his intelligence. And he's like a child that's being used by grown-ups in some immense and far-reaching play of power. This woman of Timnah betrays him. You remember that he brought them the riddle of the slain lion, the lion which he had killed.
The bees and the honey and the lion.
The bees and the honey, out of strength came forth sweetness, and they've tried for many, many days to solve the riddle, and she teased and tormented him, and he told her, and she told it to them, and then he came out with a striking phrase, if you had not plowed with my heifer, you wouldn't have answered my riddle. And notice how he is compelled to do the same thing again. This is a form of what they call deutology in another sphere of the Bible, the repetition.
Yes.
If a man is doomed to do a certain thing, he can't struggle against it. He does the same thing again with Delilah. She torments him, and in a much more serious matter, the secret of his strength and of his status as a Nazirite, as a man devoted to God. But in the first story, there was bitterness enough to have taught him a lesson, that the Philistines were ready to betray him, to kill him at any time. And
they were willing to use his wife.
Willing to use his wife. The pattern is repeated. And there is the man trapped, as it were, in this compulsion, which is not of his own making.
Now of course, whereas the woman of Timnah is simply said to press him sore, Nothing said about any wiles she uses. Delilah uses wiles that we can easily recognize as such.
Yes, the
head is on her lap.
Yes, the legends are very specific about the way she tormented him with her caresses and refusing him a satisfaction until the man was driven, this is a peculiarly apt phrase, out of his senses.
Yes, yes.
And he yielded to her. But I say, what has always haunted me about this and has given sadness to the story is here that a man may have to perform what seems a sin and in some way do wrong, is aware of it, and yet he is serving a purpose. And this is one of the riddles of the Bible, that this thing was from the Lord. And I've asked myself how we are to understand it. The Bible, after all, was edited. We don't know when the parts of it that we have now were written. They were collected afterwards, and they were edited in order to serve a moralistic purpose. And sometimes I say that I think to myself that in the editing, they had to put in certain things which they themselves could not answer. There were things that had become sacred in the memory of the people. It was folklore that couldn't be divorced from the national history and the national consciousness. And this thing remained as a riddle with which they struggled, but for which they never found a satisfactory answer.
In other words, there were stories that could not be suppressed. Maurice, I suddenly think of a parallel in our own life. Secular history tends to be written in the same fashion. That's to say, a great person, a king or a prime minister or a president or a general or whatnot, is often discussed by historians as if he represented a force, as if a trend of the times or a tendency in all history was working through him, although he is not supposed to understand that altogether. You're aware, aren't you, of how historians take figures. They may be military, they may be political, or they could be religious, indeed.
Well, it's almost inevitable. We can't assume that men know completely what they're doing. They know what they want to do, but they can't take account of all the forces which are involved and the issues which will result from their actions.
So in other words,
it's not an unjust way of dealing with these things.
In other words,
that the historian, too, may be short-sighted.
Of course he may. He may be wrong. But he is, in effect, representing men as also as being used, but in this case, you being used by history rather than by God.
Well, by the way, you just said something pregnant with meaning. By history rather than by God. The distinction of the Bible is there is no history apart from God.
That's true.
And I suppose that a profound difference between the Jews looked upon as a people and other peoples is that the Jews have no history except what happened in their struggle with God. You have American children and Jewish children in their quality as American citizens. They're learning history. This is history. Then on certain days they learn religion. But among Jewish children, if they're learning their history, they're learning their religion.
Well, this is why
they have nothing but a sacred history.
This is why I slipped in the word secular when I did. Well, now, let's have another example of a disastrous love, Maurice. The phrase interests me very much. It was a phrase that you yourself proposed.
Yes. Well, I would call Ahab and Jezebel a disastrous love, except we've touched on this before during these summer talks, except that we were much exercised with a question as to whether there was a genuine love between them, whether the word love could be applied to them. Here was this woman who was, I suppose, the arch-egotist in the Bible. I don't know of another woman or man who is so self-centered and who has this ferocity of her desires.
A ferocity of purpose.
And of purpose.
Which never changes.
Yes, completely unscrupulous, without a sense of inhibition as to the rightness, the wrongness of what she's going to do. Here is this man, and Ahab, no great shakes as a moral figure himself.
No.
Nevertheless, not evil incarnate as she is, letting himself be used by her. She is, for me, symbol of the alter egotism of human beings.
Well, Ahab As you say, of course, not a person of moral stature. Ahab, nevertheless, is capable somehow of understanding how much force is hidden in the prophet Elijah, who is the figure who will destroy him. The prophet Elijah, the quiet, excellent man, in whose very quietness and excellence there is a force that there will never be in Ahab and Jezebel put together. Elijah, just by appearing from time to time and just by letting Ahab know of his presence and of his intention to come to a certain place, Elijah, by doing that, can terrify Ahab. Ahab is capable.
Yes.
In other words, he is one of those listeners.
Yes, there is a moment when God expresses his approval. Shortly after Elijah had confronted Ahab in the garden and uttered those two Hebrew words, unfortunately, in English, they have to be expended, but in Hebrew, the three words, haratzachta, vagam yarashta, hast thou murdered and also taken possession?
Yeah.
Just the uttering of those words, it's like a thunderbolt or a lightning flash, and Ahab shrinks back, and he walked softly afterwards. He was terrified by what he had done, and God said to Elijah, do you see how he has repented? Of course, Jezebel could not be reached by anything like that.
Mm.
And she is also, for me, the symbol, I said, alter egotism, the more widely spread habit that people have of using love, and there is some kind of love there, I suppose, it's self-love, using love as the pretext for the expression of impulses which they themselves were frustrated in. Mothers showing their, or fathers showing their children off, or sometimes parents forcing their children to undertake enterprises which the children are not fit for, but the parents say, you've got to be thus and thus, you've got to be better than I was, and what they're doing is not expressing love, but their self-love using somebody else. This is all contained for me in the picture of this woman whose husband, the king of Israel, is her tool for self-aggrandizement. She is going to be the queen and, behind the scenes, the manipulator of the most powerful man in the kingdom.
Yes, you almost can suppose that it doesn't make any difference for her who Ahab is. Her love of him, if it's love at all, is not, as we said the other day, personal. I can't help thinking ever in this connection, and we've referred to this before, I cannot help thinking of the parallel in Lady Macbeth and Macbeth. Once more, Macbeth is a man who can be shaken. To whom, when the witches speak to him at the beginning of the play, trembles all over, and his heart is too big for his body. It's as if he were dying of the anticipation of terror and disaster. And of course, we all know how once he has committed the murder that he should never have tried to commit because it was not in his nature. He is shattered by it, and it goes to pieces before our very eyes, scene by scene. Lady Macbeth, at least until the very end, is utterly unperturbed. She has this ferocious singleness of purpose.
But when she breaks down, it's complete.
That's true.
Breakdown is complete.
And there's nothing like that in the case of Jezebel. Jezebel, you remember, never breaks down. She is thrown down years after
That's the first case we have of defenestration, as they call it now. She's chucked out of the window.
Years after the chief events of their story. There she is sitting in her window with her eyes painted.
Yes, the hideous old harridan. Just as fresh and evil as when she was a young woman.
And it is said, throw her down. And she's eaten by the dog.
There's a famous saying by Machiavelli that comes to my mind now. He says to people, he warns people, if you're not an evil person, don't try to do evil.
Yeah.
If you haven't got the stomach for it, stay good. A very wise remark. But we haven't much time. I want to hurry on to something, again, one of these...
Have you got another disastrous love affair?
Yes, the love affair. Is it a love affair between Amnon and Tamar, his half-sister? It's all the more incomprehensible, that affair. You remember that he violated her. He took her against her will. And yet we read that Tamar was not averse to him. You remember the sister of Absalom, perhaps?
Oh, yes. How can I forget
Amnon,
the story?
It's one of the grim stories of the Bible. She could have married him. He could have married her. Because she said to him when he approached her and expressed his passion for her and showed that he was ready to go to any length to satisfy it, she said, "Speak to the king. He will not withhold me from thee." Hmm. And that couldn't have been love then, because it could have been a straightforward love and marriage between them, and then that took place, which took place, and he sent her away, and you recalled, I think it was last week or the week before, those words, "And the hate wherewith he hated her was greater than the love with which he had loved her." Here is an instance in the Bible of an appetitional frenzy. The id, as they call it nowadays in psychoanalysis, taking hold of a man so that he doesn't know what he's doing.
And by the way, Maurice, your term disastrous fully applies here, because not only is this story itself dreadful, the story, namely, of the man who deceives his half-sister and so that she will come into his room bearing food for him. He pretends to be sick, you remember, and lies there and wants no one else other than his half-sister to wait upon him. And that seems an innocent desire. And she comes in and this thing happens, and then he hates her rather than loves her. Contrary, by the way, to Shechem.
Yes.
And Dinah, whom we discussed before. It is disastrous not only in itself. If there were no more to it, it would seem a disastrous thing, and I think your word is fine for it. But its consequences are tremendous, because it is this that Absalom hates more than anything else. Absalom kills Amnon.
Yes.
Absalom never forgives.
He has him killed in the end.
Never forgives Amnon for this. And that, in turn, I've always supposed, somehow leads to the eminence that Absalom obtains among his brothers and among the men of the kingdom. It's his first taste of power, if you please. It's his first taste of blood.
It might very well be considered as a contributory factor in the embitterment of Absalom, or the awakening of the lust for power in him. Let me go back to what I was talking about earlier, some minutes ago, when I speak of men apparently being forced to sin in order to fulfill a purpose. There's an old story, a very old story, the relationship between Judah, the son of Jacob, and his daughter-in-law, Tamar. The same name.
Oh, yes.
Remember?
Yeah, there are a number of Tamars in the Bible.
Yes, and how she deceived him into thinking that she was a harlot, and he was tempted, and he went with her, and
because she wanted a child by him.
She wanted a child by him. Thomas Mann treated in a magnificent fashion. He said this was the woman who was blindly determined to thrust her way into divine history.
Yeah.
She felt that this family carried the historic religious destiny of the world, and she was determined at all costs to be in it. Now, the rabbis are exercised about the situation. They talk of Judah being reluctant. He didn't want to do this thing. When the woman tempted him, he turned away, and he was practically forced, and they said, this is what you have to do, what you have to fulfill. So that there again, there is the riddle coming out from ancient days and leaving in our minds an echo of situations in which we find ourselves when we have done wrong and that has turned out well. We've done something against our conscience, and in the end we see we didn't understand what we were doing, as the contrary too.
Well, you remember, Joseph says to his brothers, who had treated him so badly, when they finally come to Egypt and are reconciled with him, recognized by him and reconciled with him, and they are so full of contrition for the past, Joseph said to them, as I remember, never fear, perhaps what you did was necessary.
This thing was of God.
That the people be saved. If you hadn't done this, I wouldn't have been here when the famine came. You would not have found a friend in Egypt, not to speak of a brother, and the people would have been lost. Yes, there is that thing that's always coming through. It has been called Providence. You know, there are various names for this thing.
You know, let me interrupt, Mark. It suddenly occurs to me. Perhaps when a man repents for a wrong that he's done, he should also pray. Maybe it served the purpose that I didn't know I was wrong, but I pray that good will come out of it, even though I mustn't forgive myself for it.
By the way, providence means, etymologically, foreseeing, doesn't it?
Yes.
Seeing yes. Beforehand. In other words, it is assumed that there is one who foresees the consequences of all acts. Although, as you yourself said a few minutes ago, perhaps no man ever knows all that is involved in any of his own actions. No man, in other words, completely knows what he is doing.
You know, this talk has rather depressed me, thinking of these things. I'd like to wind up on a lighter note. You know, there's a ridiculous love story in the Bible, too.
What's that?
The story of the love of Ahasuerus for Esther. There's something quite ridiculous about it.
Well, how is that ridiculous?
Well, it's ridiculous because the circumstances under which he chooses her. First of all, he gets drunk at a banquet and asks his wife to come and show herself, Vashti, to come and show herself and all her beauty, and she refuses, flies into a rage, and then he starts looking for a wife, and the way he does it is to send out messengers to all the 127 provinces, find me the nicest girls. And they're to be brought to him, and they're prepared, and they're perfumed, and they're rubbed with oils, and he's got to see every one of them and pick out, I don't know, suppose there were two from each province.
Yes.
So he's got to examine
254.
Thank you. 254, and finally he decides in favor of Esther. It's a ridiculous story. The rabbis actually say that Esther never consummated the marriage with him. But there is about it. They call him, you know, the fool king.
Yes. Although
the Melatipish, he's a fool of a man.
Yes, although once more, maybe in a somewhat grotesque context, the same thing happens, doesn't it? That is to say, Esther's experience there, Esther's adventure, is one of the ways in which, once more, the people are saved.
Yes, that is the great role which she plays. The Book of Esther, by the way, as we've mentioned before, was looked on by suspicion by the rabbis. They were of half a mind to keep it out of the Bible. Well, I'm glad that this subject, which I had to bring up of these what I call disastrous loves, we've got through it.
Well, it was your
subject. Yes. Let's talk next week about some very beautiful ones as we draw toward the end of our talks for this summer. Let's talk next week about Ruth and Naomi and Boaz.
That will be a relief.
Just heard The Words We Live By, the 11th in the 15-week Eternal Life Summer Series. Be with us again next week when Maurice Samuel and Professor Mark Van Doren will resume their discussion of love, human and divine. The Words We Live By is produced under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This pre-recorded program has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation.
Next, monitor news on the hour on NBC Radio.